Prosciutto Rosso Colau, everyone here. Today I'd like to focus on the topic Tainos Piron de Xuba, and the relationship of the general look of this idea of cleaning parati in various different situations. As Roy Willig pointed out when I told him about my topic, and was anticipated also several years before by the Chalkas Mechokek on the Shulchan Aruch, that Bizman Hazeh, we don't really have situations where a ksuba is forgiven or paid back without the knowledge of Beis Din, so a lot of this conversation is somewhat theoretical. One other general overview. This is the first time I'm sharing words of Torah in a formal capacity since the passing of Rilkenstein, and I'm personally indebted to so much of what I've become in terms of my Talmud Torah to him and to the Derech that I was privileged to be able to take a little bit of time to learn from. It's not the place, or am I worthy enough to go further, except to mention that some of the ideas in this Chabura were distilled from some of the Torah that I was privileged enough to hear from him. So with that, I'd like to jump in. I'd like to start the Gemara in our Masechta in Ksuvos on Pei Ches, with the Mishnah. The Mishnah writes that Hotziya Get, if a woman comes with a Get and she doesn't have a Ksuba with her, she's go with a Ksuba. Rashi points out, Al-Atar, that the reason why Rashi points out that you can't claim that it was paid back, because Mishum Ditznai Ksuba Maisa Basedin Hu. That Ditznai Ksuba is Maisa Basedin. Rashi points out this based on the Gemara in Baba Metzia, on Daf Yud Zayin, where Rabbi Yochanan posits that Hatoin Achar Maisa Basedin Lo Amar Klum. That if someone makes a claim after a quote-unquote Maisa Basedin, it doesn't work. What exactly is the nature of its rejection? Hopefully we'll discuss. My time, what's the reason? Kol Maisa Basedin, what's the reason for this? Because any Maisa Basedin is as if the person has a shtar in their hand. And again, the relationship of what that means, that a Maisa Basedin means that there's some type of shtar here, also is something that we'll hope to examine. The Gemara in Baba Metzia continues and explains, it connects it directly with our Gemara hearing Suas, and points out that this is the reason for our Gemara. Abaye, on the other hand, takes a pause and suggests maybe it's not. Dilmah Malkum Shekosvim Ksuba Askinan. Maybe in our Gemara in Ksuvos, that it's really a case of Malkum She'en Kosvim. That we have situations where there are times where the minhag is to actually write a Ksuba, and we have other situations where apparently the minhag was not to write a Ksuba, but to rely on the fact that Ksuba is not based in, and that would suffice for the chiyuv in place of a physical document of ksuba. And while the Gemara continues, I just want to pause here for a second and question what exactly is Abaye arguing with Rabbi Yochanan. And it seems like there are two possible issues here. On the one hand, it could be Abaye is arguing that really there is no replacement for a shtar. And as great as a Maisa Basin is, there's no place for a shtar. Our Mishnah, where the woman produces a get is a shtar, and the chiddush really is just underscoring the fact that a shtar gerushin can play some type of role that would work like a ksuba. On the flip side, it could be Abaye really does agree in part to Rabbi Yochanan Shita.
Where is Abaye?
What?
Right here.
It's on source number 3. I wrote it in. For some reason, the printer didn't want to copy that one. Or alternatively, really Abaye agrees to Rabbi Yochanan, just the scope of what Abaye understands, this din is far more limited, i.e. that it only applies in cases, in situations where we don't, b'makom she'en kosim ksuba. We'll get back to this distinction as we develop, but one interesting nafkamina that comes up in the Siman Shulchan Aruch that this conversation kind of coalesces around, which is Simen Kuf Vav, is what exactly in this situation is needed in terms of our case of a Mishnah. A woman comes to collect, she doesn't have her ksuba, so she has a get. Would Eidei Kiddush, would Eidei Gerushin count as well? And that seems to be machlokas. And I think it stems from exactly this situation. What exactly is the nature of the conversation between Abaye and Rabbi Yochanan? Ultimately, is there a need for a shtar of some sort? Or does Maaseh Beis Din even trump the need for a shtar? And then we have to ask ourselves, why exactly would that matter, whether it's Makom Shekosvim or not? Either way, Basof, Abaye retracts and suggests that even the case of Makom Shekosvim, where we do have Ksuba, a woman is Neman Selechter Ksuba, and the Baal cannot claim Prati. Either way, for both of these sugyas, the common denominator seems to be the fact as a question about whether we can claim Prati or not. Rashi over here and Tosos, as well as many other Rishonim, suggest that. I say that to the exclusion of one particular sheet of the Baal Mor, who understands our Gemara and Bava Basra, Bava Metzia, to be a situation of whether we write a shovar or not, which reflects slightly different. And as we see the Baal Mor in his discussion and other things, it's important to keep that in mind, that he understands this whole Gemara slightly different. That's really a conversation about whether we write a shovar for Ksuba or not. So going back to our main Gemara, the Gemara in Ksubos on Pei Tes, which is apparently in the Yom of Daf Yomi. So the Gemara has Machlokas, Rav and Shmuel. I want to jump a little bit, Halacha L'maisa, how do we pass in the Halacha? The Rif writes, Alatar, in Ksubos, Hosi Get, in this situation where she brings out a Get, that we are oaking the case, Shmuel, like Shmuel, but Makom She'en Kosvim Ksuba, the Halacha Kavaseh, that we hold, like Shmuel, in particular in the case of where a get is not written, meaning, a Ksuba is not written. Meaning, the Makom She'en Kosvim Ksuba, a woman can collect with her get, and the Baal can't claim Parati. Whereas, B'makom Shekosvim Ksuba, where a woman does receive a Ksuba, a woman is not Naaman to collect her Ksuba in a situation where she just shows up with a get. This distinction seems at first glance to be at odds with the Gemara in Bava Metzia. In particular, the Rif on this Gemara seems to be somewhat a question. There are some Rishonim that claim that the Rif took this out. It's in brackets in our Gemara. And the Rif in Bava Metzia seems to maybe tell a different story, that there is no distinction between Makom Shekosvim or not, that either way, a woman is really allowed to claim her Ksuba and is shielded from this claim of Parati from the Baal. Either way, the Rambam is unequivocal, accepts this distinction. The Rambam in Hilchos Ishos, Tes Zayin Chaf Ches, writes that a woman who is Motzi her get, Be'en B'yada Shtar Ksuba, and she doesn't have a shtar ksuba in derech lo so makom shelo yichvu ksuba. If in that situation, if it's a place where they don't write ksuba, that's not the minhag. She's able to be gove the ikar ksuba. But if the derech of that place is to write the ksuba, she doesn't even get to be gove the ikar ksuba. On the flip side, so we have this distinction developed by the Rif, maybe, and definitely by the Rambam. On the flip side, the Tosvos, the Baal HaTosfos, as well as the Baal Maor, who we mentioned, understand that the Gemara in Bava Metzia is really the general rule, the halacha, and takes it quite literally that there's no distinction between Makom Shekosvim and Makom She'en Kosvim. The Baal Maor even makes the claim that the Rif means that, and he does a little bit of interesting calculations, but he also assumes that the Rif holds that way. Interestingly enough, the Shulchan Aruch follows the Rambam, who is quoting to claim to follow the Rif, whereas the Ramah quotes a sheet of the Baal HaTosfos, and the Baal Maor, who also think that it stems from the Rif, in opposition, meaning the Shulchan Aruch quotes that there's a difference between Makom Shekosvim and Makom She'en Kosvim, whereas the Ramah writes this halacha like the Baal HaTosfos at the clean of this distinction. If a woman comes to get, she's able to be gove her ksuba. So that, in somewhat, is an overview, a synopsis of the different moving parts and what we're talking about. In particular, we have this question about the situation of whether it's Makom Shekosvim, and therefore there might be a machlokes whether she's able to be gover her get Gova with her get, the ksuva. And a situation of Makom She'ein Kosvim, where it seems like, according to everyone, we have a situation where the Baal is not Neman Tzei Parati. One other distinction that comes up here, as well as many other places, is a question about whether there's a potential difference in how we look at the Iker of the Ksuva and the Tosefes. That maybe those their status halachically should reflect upon a difference of whether she's Neman, whether he's Neman to claim Parati, depending on what are the other factors in play. So that's a little bit of the dry details of what exactly go into this conversation. In the hopes of trying to tease out a little bit about what is the situation of this Tainus Piron and this idea that the Baal can claim or not claim Praticha, I wanted to survey a little bit of different times where this type of claim is rejected. And look at some of the factors of why it's rejected. For example, and really more as a template, we have a Gemara in Bava Metzia and Yud Zayin, a little bit before the Gemara that we're looking at, that a person is called to court and is told that he owes Reuven money. And he claims that that never happened. They never borrowed. And then Edom come and they claim, no, there was indeed a halva, and that you do owe money to Reuven. And then this individual tries to claim that he paid it back, that he was porea the chov already. So in that situation, the Gemara says that he's huksak kafron, and he's no longer accepted to be able to make a claim by that money. So here we see a situation where the taina of parati is not accepted, but for no reason other than that the person who's suggesting it seems to have a type of psul gavra of sorts, that the individual, and I know that's somewhat of a loaded term, that the individual lacks a certain ne'emanus, regardless of what claim this individual tried to put forth, those claims lack a certain ability to move forward. And the question to look at as we look at these are, what are the underlying reasons of why a certain claim would be rejected, in particular in our situation in Parati? And does it stem from this ne'emanut that's lacking, a lack of belief, or is there something else at play? So another situation that to look at is the Gemara in Bava Metzia. I'm sorry, in Bava Basra and Daf Hey Amud Aleph. The Gemara has a conversation where Rabbi Shlakish points out that a person is not neman to claim that someone was poreil chov v'toch zman. Acher zman, what even a person who's a claim that acher zman, that claim would have been accepted, if I claim that I paid back within a certain time period, you're not neman to make that claim. Abaye and Rava and Nakamura disagree, then they give a reason why. The reason is maybe the Baal Chov decided that he wanted to be done with this situation. He tried to pay up early. But we seem to paskin like Rabbi Shlakish that there's an assumption that a person isn't Poreh Chov Tochsmano. And therefore, if a person claims Parati Tochsmano, it's not accepted. We follow that basis, that assumption, that psychology is so pervasive that it undercuts the din in situations where we would expect that wouldn't be the case. One in particular example is the situation of Yesomim, where if someone were to come to a situation, normally a person can't take money, haba minichse yisomim, need a shvua. In this situation, because his nemanus is so undercut by this assumption of this psychology, that parati doesn't, you can, that a person has to pay back and can take from the nichse yisomim even without a shvua. In both these situations, we see that there's an underlining deficiency.
He doesn't need a shvua if he's being pogaya from.
He doesn't need a shvua if he's being pogaya from nifsei yisomim. So even though in almost all other situations, if you're coming, even if you have good claims, you're coming to be to take from nifsei yisomim, you have to take a shvua. In our situation, since this umdana, this assumption is so prevalent and so pervasive that in the believability of that claim is so annihilated that in order that even a shvua isn't required to be able to be gova in that situation. And in both of these situations, the pattern that seems to be developing is that there seems to be a baseline Ne'emanos situation, and as the individual would lack that for some particular reason, this din would be dismissed. Moving on to a case closer to what we're dealing with, the Gemara that we just talked about in Bava Metzia and Yudzayin about a Maisa based din. So as we mentioned, there seems to be Rabbi Yochanan's statement, at first glance, is simple, but includes a little bit of complexity. In particular, it seems like there's a chiddush that a Maisa based din is like a shtar, almost like a milvah b'shtar. And that is based on the premise that a milvah b'shtar would not have the ability that someone would lack the ability to be towing parati against a milvah b'shtar. And I'd like to look at for the next couple of minutes about what is that bait premise, the fact that a milvah b'shtar seems to lack this ability of parati. So we have a number of Gemaras. We're going to look at the Gemara in the Mishnah in Bava Basra on Kuf Ayin Hey, because we're going to visit it for the different scenarios that are listed there. But we see very clearly from there that a shtar chov, that is hamilvat chaver b'shtar, you go there from mishubadim, you not only get a pick of whether you get to take back from the person who borrowed from you directly, or from different lekuchos and different mishubadim, but also when there's a kosher shtar, there's very little that this individual can do to prevent you from doing that. It comes up in a number of situations. Gemara and Shavuos talks about the fact that a person has a shtar, there's not really much you can do in face of that. And ultimately the question is, why is that? Why is a shtar so powerful? Now, if you're wondering how come we've been talking so long about shtar and parati and we haven't said shtar chabiyadi ma bai, here's where it makes its grand entrance. The conventional thinking is, of course, that there seems to be this underlining assumption that in this situation, when the shtar is present, because the fact that the shtar is there, the shtar is this ultimate trump card. And if I had really paid you back, would I have left such a powerful weapon in your arsenal? Of course not. I would have demanded the shtar back. I would have made sure that it was destroyed. And the fact that it still is existence, and the fact that you have it and you have control of it, shows a certain vulnerability in my claim that I paid you back. After all, no one would lead such strong grounds for someone to hold on to that shtar. I think that's the conventional thinking among many Rishonim about what exactly is the baseline of the shtar. Moving on to the next case the next idea of the case in this Mishnah in Bava Basra, we have a milveh be'edim. That if someone lends their friend money via Edim, or in the presence of Edim, more accurately, that they're not goveh from Mishubadim, but they're goveh from Nechasim B'nei Chor. And the question becomes, the Gemara in Shavuos, about whether someone needs to pay back Bifnei Edim. If I borrow money, Milveh V'Edim, do I have to pay back Bifnei Edim? There's a debate in the Gemara, and ultimately the Gemara in Shavuos on Mem Aleph on the base points out that you don't need to pay back Bifnei Edim only if it's expressly defined that you have to pay back before Edim, and if not, you don't have to. And the Ran here describes, in the same footsteps that we've been discussing, the various different parameters, the various different situations that there's this conversation about when this particular claim is rejected. The Ran explains that in the Havamina, we assume that if you're lent money in front of Edim, it's a very public matter, and that therefore, if I don't pay back the loan in front of Edim, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't create a situation where everyone knows I borrowed money, and when I pay back, then I'm not going to have this defense that I pay back. I'm not just going to go and send back alley behind my building on 181st and pay back Bifnei Edim. The Ran has such a strong language. It's not just a rove, it's not just a chazaka, but there's an anan sade that you won't pay back before, not before Edim, and then therefore when you claim that you pay back and you don't have Edim that you didn't do it before Edim, it's Anan Sadeh that you were Meshaker, that you're lying. Similar as we've seen on all the situations that we've described heretofore, the Ran corrals this case again in the direction that there seems to be some type of psychological underpinning that would create someone that would leave someone there in a situation where they're unable to claim parati. The Ran describes this as the Shaktari of the Gemara. The Reisha, the first part of the Gemara where we thought that the Hapnida, that any Mal of the Edim needs to be Porea Bifnei Edim, the Gemara thought that maybe that was enough. That was public enough that even though I didn't have the specific warning to pay back before Edim, but once you're doing it in public, we would take that. The Gemara then reassesses and says, no, Akhtay Kach, we're not going to say. But when someone specifically comes to you and says, you can borrow this money, Bifnei Edim, but you have to pay back, explicitly before Edim, so in that situation, when you're warned so specifically, that the psychology of any person would make sure that in order to pay back the actual loan, you're going to do it before Edim.
Maybe you're giving up your stosatayna of parati.
Thank you. We'll get to that. But the Ran doesn't think that. The Ran thinks that there's a chashash mechshaker. There's an anisade. They're in there coming. That's saying that you're lying. But as you just pointed out, maybe you can read the sugya fundamentally differently. And I think you can. And I think that because I saw the Rimagash. The Rimagash takes the sugya exactly in the direction that you were saying. The Rimagash understands that the sugya hinges upon a totally different axis. It's not about what are the psychological underpinnings? What are my what would I act upon? What makes sense for me to do? We don't care about that. There's something that comes in before that. What are the rules of the game that we're playing? What are the legal underpinnings? In this situation, the two partners join into a freely agreed upon venture, and they set certain parameters for that venture. And to what extent do we accept that? And what extent are those parameters directly expressed? So the Rimagash actually points out that really this is a whole other conversation. This is a question about to what extent can people function on their own Shulchan Aruch? To what situation can they write their own Dinei Kol Shein Mishpat? We have situations of that Darvish B'Mamon with a Tanai, whether that's Kaim or not. This is a well known machlokas. And so the question, the conversation at play here is an outgrowth of that conversation. If I set up that I'm going to borrow before Edim, and I'm explicitly warned that you have to pay back Bifnei Edim, so in that situation, it's not that I'm not believed to say Parati without Edim. That's not a Piron. Piron in this situation is defined as paying back before Edim. The Rimagash is the lashon that there was an Azhara, that you were specifically warned, this is the only way you can do it. And I think, and then the question becomes, at what point can I continue to make those rules? Can I say only if you pay, between two people who are in the Yan Kol? And to what extent do the two parties have to agree to that? And so I think that's definitely the direction that Rimagash takes, that there's a more fundamental question about the rather than the psychology, but what are the rules of the game? And I think the Rambam also goes in this direction. The Rambam in the Malva Lova Tesvav Aleph writes exactly this situation and points out that you have to start the furrow before the Eidim B'nei time. B'fnei Atznai, sorry. Sort of the form of the Edim B'nei Atznai. You have to pay back before Edim because there is Tznai. And even later on, when he says you're not Neman, he says because there was a certain Tznai that was created. In my effort to try to uncover a place where the Rambam writes a situation where Shtarach Abiyadi Magbayi or some type of more psychological reason, it seems not to be found anywhere in the Mishnah Torah. Although I'd be corrected if someone could point something out. And so I think over here we have this beginning of a different way of looking at this whole sugya. the situation that it's not about practical ne'eman, it's not about whether I'm believed or whether what would psychology dictate that a person acts and therefore weigh that against what I'm trying to say. But there are certain rules at play. In this situation, there are rules that we establish as the partners in this venture, and those rules have to be followed. And I think that's one short pivot towards a much broader question, or a much broader way of looking at this, that there, all of Dine Mumnos are certain understandings, and there are certain rules, and there are certain requirements. And then depending on the different variables in any situation, there are certain burdens of proof that shift from one party to the other party, and that a question of a taina parati might not be in place when the burden of proof is on you to claim, is on you to prove that you're the quote unquote nachayev in that situation. And we'll expand that and look at that more fully right now. But just to finish up in the Gemara and Shavuos, so there seems to be, I would suggest, three ways to read the Gemara. There's the way that the Ran reads it, that it's all the Havamina and the Maskana is a question about psychology. And at the end of the day, we say only when you're explicitly warned, and that's when you have an Anansade that you're Meshaker. On the polar opposite of that, you have the situation like the Rimagash, that seems to be all a function of what are the rules of the game and how explicit are those rules enunciated at different points, and that might be the tipping point between the first and the second. And then a middle opinion, I think, presents itself, that maybe this is part of what the conversation of the Gemara is. On the one hand, the first opinion, that anytime you're Poreya Bifne Edim, that can be, there's a certain psychology to that, and that you have to be, I'm sorry, anytime that you're Mal Bifne Edim, there's a certain psychology to that, and that you would have to do it in public, that would force an individual. Whereas the Gemara shifts and says only when you're explicitly warned, saying, well, that might be true, but we don't really care so much about what they're going to talk about, in between, during Hagba and Shul, whether you pay back or not. What matters is what's the onus of burden on him or not, and that's only when it's explicitly expressed. I think this middle ground rears its head again at the end in a more halachal maisa fashion. So now, looking back at what we've discussed heretofore, there seems to be two tracks evolving and presenting itself that present that explain situations where the taina parati is rejected. The first is this psychological lack of nemanut, lack of belief that there's some reason why we should believe that we should think that action isn't the case, or this other idea that there seems to be situations where the rules of the game, the burdens of proof, reflect situations where you're no longer applicable, you're no longer accepted to be able to make this claim because of the situation, the different variables in the process. And that, would read from, just to play out a Stam case, I borrow money, the assumption is that I can, without any Edim, without any Shtar, the assumption is I'm Neman to say I can pay back. The Cheskas Chiyuv versus my emission that I took and I paid back. Maybe it's some of the Rishonim talk a little bit about a Peshas or Pesha Hitzer in this situation. But a baseline case is if I borrow money and then I'm called that I owe this money, I say I paid it back. So a general times parati, I'm allowed because that's the baseline amount. You have to prove that I didn't pay back. You have to prove that the loan exists. I'm going to do that for you by saying that I borrowed money, but I paid it back. So Pesha Hitzer. In that situation, it's, your move. You can prove that I didn't pay it back. When I raise the ante a little and I have Edim on the loan, so then there becomes more of a challenge. I have more of a unshakable Cheskas Chiyuv. And then we have to start talking about that. And then the question of, quite literally, Hamotzi Mechavero Alvaraya, who is this? It's really a question in each of these situations, just who's the raya on. And no longer a question of whether I believe you or not, as much as a question of what is in my rights, what are the burden of proofs, what's the lineage of what's the statute say that I have to prove from my side to counter your side. And with that, I'd like to revisit what we saw by Milo Bishtar. We saw by middle of the shtar that it seems shtar chaviyadi ma'vai. This is, you know, impeccable psychological proof, the fact that that's what exists. But we see the Rambam, again, the Rambam, I think, situation puts that the fact that a shtar here is in play changes the burden of proof solely on the fact of the person who the lova, and therefore the lova has to prove that he paid it back. And just saying that would not be enough. Whether we believe him or not, whether he, whatever he wants, whatever tricks or that he would want to do to prove that, it needs to be a clear-cut claim because the burden of proof have now shifted to him. Moving, in this situation, Rav Lichtenstein was talking about this in a different situation. He pointed out that sometimes he has heard that they quoted in the name of Rav Chaim for the Rambam that a milvah b'shtar is a situation where ki'ilu, the person said, you have to pay back with ne'edim. And if that is the case, that would fit nicely with what we're saying over here. It's about describing what are the rules of the game and how do those rules apply. Now, Rav Lichtenstein, for intellectual honesty, thought that this was what people say in the name of Rav Chaim and not really what Rav Chaim said. And he thought, for a number of different reasons, that was not the case. But I think in our situation, this would speak to a little bit of the question of, is this a question of psychology? Or is this a question of who has the burden of proof? And how are those rules established towards vis-a-vis people's responsibility towards one another? Coming back to the third case, in the Gemara on Kuf Ayin Hey, I said we're going to talk about the three of those cases in the Mishnah there. So we have a situation, we talk about Shtar, Milu Be'edim, and now we have Ksav Yado. What happens in the situation? We have Ksav Yado. So Ksav Yado, I write something, I owe you money, two of your brander, and I give it to someone. Can I claim Prati against this? So that's Machlokes, Rishonim, of course. The Baal Maor feels very strongly that you cannot claim prati against that. This and his language, his verbiage is, this is like a shtar. This is as damaging as a shtar. Why would I leave someone that power to be able to be goveh from me if I really paid it back? Must be I didn't, and therefore ksav yado would you can't claim prati against. The Rif, on the other hand, says that you can. He says that you can. Why? So I think that there are two possible answers, and I think they fit a little bit into this. First is the Ramban explicitly. And the Ramban goes, big vote, the Baal Maor, and really corrals the Rif again towards the side that this is more of a question of what's an individual psychology. The Ramban understands that, let's say we start from the premise that Ksav Yado is not a shtar. Which it isn't. I can't be gover from Mishubadim. You have to come to me. I have to come. You can't just go bother my lakuchos. If that's the situation, and I pay you back, I'm not so worried about getting that back. After all, you're going to come to me, and you're going to tell me you owe me money. And I'm going to tell you I paid you back. I don't care that you have that piece of writing. It doesn't really do this. It's not such valuable. It's not so valuable for you. Because you can't be gove mishubadim, you can't go to my lekuchos, you can't go to third parties, as opposed to a shtar. You could start talking to other people. You don't have to deal with me. You could bother other people with a shtar. And so, based on that, leaving an IOU with someone, based on its lesser power, would mean that therefore it's not such a big indicator now that I left it there. In some ways, it's somewhat circular, but not really, in that by the fact that the IOU is really has a lesser stature, therefore my leaving it there signals less, and that does not signal enough to devoid me of my chance to claim parati. On the other hand, I think it's possible to understand, within the legal framework that we've been talking about, this idea that really the Rif saying parati because we're pegging the ksav yado at a certain point. It's different than a shtar. And once the shtar is not there, the burdens of proof in this situation don't change. And therefore, just like I was neman to say prati before, I'm neman to say prati now because I was always neman. Who cares? The only time that I wouldn't be able to is when a shtar comes into play. And this isn't a shtar. So, As we've seen so far, it seems like there are two ways of describing this parati. We've described that there seems to be a lack of ne'emanos, which we talked about toch zmano. We talked about milu b'shtar according to most rishonim. We talked about b'fnei edim by the Ran, and l'ksav yado according to the Rif, according to the Ramban, and also the opinion of the Baal Mor. On the flip side, looking at this as a situation where there are certain legal parameters that prevent me from making certain claims, I think that the Rimagash makes that point very clearly. The way you can understand, the Rambam, I think, makes that point in different situations, as well as this other understanding of the Rif and the baseline understanding of Ksav Yado. All of that brings us back to our main point about Maisa Beis Din and Ksuba. So what exactly happens by Maisa Beis Din? What does it mean that it's as if there's like a shtar? So, either, depending on the way we look at this, it could be that there's not really a shtar, but there's something similar. Just like in a shtar, you're compelled to pay before Eidim because of the situation, the fact that shtar is very public. So too, a Maisa Beis Din is a chov fashioned by Beis Din in public. You can't just make some private deal on the side. Everyone knows that you have the schiyuv. In order to discharge the schiyuv, you would want to do it in public. And the fact that you didn't do that in public means that you didn't pay back. Alternatively, our legalistic understanding is that this chov fashioned by Beis Din, your total burden of responsibility is to pay it back in a manner that is public in this situation. And therefore, any type of secret arbitration, you paid it in private, where it's not clearly extolled in Beis Din, it's as if you didn't pay it. There's a third shita about what this means exactly by Maisa Beis Din. There's a Ravid in the Shita Mikveses who writes that it is as if that Beis Din actually wrote you a shtar. Which I think, depending on how you look at these different situations, could fit in either one. But I just wanted to put that out there as a unique, interesting shita. Coming back to the matter at hand with our ksuba, I think that the two variables that we posited at the beginning, the difference between Tosefes and Iker, and Makom Shekosvim, Makom Shein Kosvim, play a significant role in deciding this situation. Many Rishonim understand, first we'll deal with the Tosefes and the Iker. Many Rishonim understand that your Goveh, like in our situation, in our first Mishnah, that we talked about ages ago, with the get, that you can be goved the Iker Ksuba and not the Tosefes. And that there seems to be a split here. On one hand, there's a question about the general relationship between Tosefes and Iker, which we've discussed in this format already. In examining this, there seems to be really two types of Tosefes. We have Tosefes that the individual takes upon themselves, that whatever they decide, they're very giving on the day of their wedding, and they throw into the ksuba a very large additional. And then there are, for lack of a better term, a communal tosefes that already exists in the time of the Ramah and well before, that there's just this understanding, the Gemara even talks about, there's a Beis Din of Kohanim that they pay, that they add to their ksuba a certain amount. And that we might see the distinction that the personal tosefes is put in on one hand, whereas the communal, the standard Tosefes, really is included with the general Tosefet. Again, a time where I had the opportunity to hear Rav Lichtenstein describe it, he described it as a question of, if the Iker Ksuba is a big cake, do we look at the Tosefes as icing on top of the cake, the frosting, or do we look at it as a larger cake, a swollen cake? And I think the question here is, the standard Tosefes would definitely make it into the Iker Ksuba, whereas this individual Tosefes would be a standalone icing on the cake, for lack of a better term. So again, looking at this situation, it seems to be there are two entities. What is my ability in each of these situations? So if I take this more psychological approach, so the Iker is a Tanai based in, so I might be more compelled to pay that properly, while this private addition of my goodwill, I might not be as careful to pay. The psychology of that might not be as strong. I might be more willing to cut a side deal. I'm not as careful about what the whole olam's going to think of whether I fulfilled my obligation. Maybe. But I think if you look at it from the legal end, you make a much stronger case. You have to ask yourself, how are these chovos fashioned? The Tosefis is fashioned as a Maisa Basin. You have an obligation to pay that back in a public manner, and therefore it's on you to prove that. You have no ability, the way that chov is forged is a situation where you're not able to claim parati. Whereas I'm adding of my own goodwill a separate chov, so that has the same standards of other chovos. And if you don't have the shtar for that, i.e. the soup is missing, so I might be able to get out of that with parati because I no longer, you no longer have the balance of the burden of proof on my end. It's now been diffused, and therefore I'm able to stand up to that.
Is Tani based in only on the Iker Ksuba? Is it also on Tosefis? I thought it was only on the Iker.
So what I'm trying to say is that maybe we could distinguish between the different types of Tosefis, but this individual Tosefis might be only on the Tosefis. Might be only on the Iker. Not on the Tanai.
I thought for Tosefis, you have to write that down.
What? For Tosefis, you have to write it down. Right. Yeah. And there's even the question.
How could you say Parati if you have it?
Right, so I'm saying in the case where she doesn't have the shtar, where she just has the get, she should be able to go over the tosef, the ksuba, the ikar ksuba, because that's snai based in. But to get the tosefes, she doesn't have a shtar. It's like another chov. If you don't have a shtar, I'm sorry. I think even further, there's a conversation about what happens when I have a shtar that's not mekuyam. Let's say I have a ksuba. Actually, I didn't lose the ksuba, it's just not mekuyam. So can I be gove the Tosefis or not? So it seems like the Chalkos Machlokes and very other people talk about that you might not be able to.
Okay, someone actually says that you can say Parati, you cannot say Parati on the Tosefis if she doesn't produce a...
No, that you can. Does someone actually say that? No. So you can always say Parati.
Right.
So I'm just saying that fits in nicely with this understanding that why should it be different? It's all one... Seems to be one thing. So one way of looking at it might be because the different ways that it's developed, meaning the Iker has a certain Tanai based in backing, whereas the Tosefis is just a Stam Chov that I set up for myself that I is governed by the rules of Stam Chovim. The last variable at play here. Makom shekosvim versus makom she'en kosvim. So if you go in the direction that this is an olam of legal axioms, so it shouldn't make a difference whether I'm kosvim or not. The chov is fashioned from a tznai based in, and therefore whether you have a ksuva or not, my ability to pay that chov, my ability to prove that chov shouldn't depend on whether she has her ksuva or not. On the other hand, to see the people who distinguish between Makom Shekosvim and Makom She'eino Kosvim, it seems to be, if you understand that there's a certain psychology involved, so in a place where all ksubos are created equal, then you write a shtar for one of them, and then she loses that. So there's in a situation where she didn't have a shtar to begin with, so there's no deficiency in her claim. She's claiming her ksuba, where's your shtar? I never had a shtar. Makom She'eino Kosvim. Fine, Tanai Beis Din backs her up. But in this situation, she has a shtar that's formed because of Tanai Beis Din. She loses that shtar. There's now a deficiency in her claim. That crack in her ne'emanus enables him to be able to make the claim of parati. That reyosa in her ne'emanus enables him to be, transfers to him certain amounts of nemons. And I think over here, maybe it might be room for a slight split situation where the Makom Shekosvim, so the Makom She'eino Kosvim, it's all Maisa Beis Din. Maisa Beis Din, you have certain obligations. It is afforded the rights and honors and privileges and responsibilities of any other Maisa Beis Din because there's no shtar. On the other hand, Malcolm Shikosvim, once a shtar is ridden, you might be able to say that then it devolves into the situation of a regular milva b'shtar. And as long as that shtar exists, it's governed by the same parameters of shtar, and that would fall into the same conversation we had before about what's the nature of milva b'shtar. Is the deficiency in the time of Praticha neged milva b'shtar an issue of psychology or the rules that are established based on how that works exactly? I think there are a couple other ramifications to this in terms of Nisraf and Nevad, but I'm not going to get into that right now. Just to recap a little bit, essentially we saw two different ideas. One, that the deficiency in Tanis Parati is that there is a lack of Ne'emanus, and that is developed or based upon what the Ran would suggest, that what common behavior would dictate, and once you deviate from that common behavior, there's an ansade that you're Meshaker. On the flip side, maybe the sheet of the Rambam really throughout in this situation is that it's a question of my legal responsibility, my legal liability, and that depending on the burden of proof and the various different variables in play, that would dictate at what situation do I have certain room to make certain claims, and what situation would that be inappropriate because it's my obligation to really prove my side. With that, I will leave you. Thank you.
The next two, I'm going to say, okay? 3:00.